I want to talk to you about effort processing. I'm not going to talk to you very broadly or widely about this, but I'm going to give it a quick skim with some new basic axioms to lead in, and I want to give you an example of what might possibly happen to you in this process. Now, at this moment, effort processing is an experimental procedure. It used to be in the old days, back in Elizabeth, whenever you had an experimental procedure, the students would take to this experimental procedure rather than learning standard procedures, and there would be consequent tumult. So this was taken into account by all of the staff, and it was finally announced that the best thing to do with an experimental procedure was to keep it under hack. Be very careful with it, not let anybody know about it. And then things really got interesting, very interesting, because you see, some little factor of this experimental procedure would leak. And the students would hear about it anyhow, and the pre-clears would hear about this wonderful new gimmick-a-hoojit, and nobody would know anything about it, and they'd do it anyway. So things got more interesting than otherwise. Therefore, the wisest course on any line like this is when an experimental procedure is in the offing, it's fairly well established that there's something there, to start talking about it as much as you know when you know it. That is easily the wisest course, and people who start experimenting with it at least know as much as research knows about it. And they also know that it's experimental, not that something's being kept under lock and key because it's so good that it would invalidate the textbook, or it's so good that what it is really is the instructors want to keep it to themselves so they can make spectacular recoveries in cases that the students can't. Well, I've heard some interesting ones on this one. In mathematics, there's the analogy of the two-dimensional worm. A two-dimensional worm would be a worm who was two-dimensional, who lived on a two-dimensional plane. You see, this plane would have length and breadth, but no depth, no height. Now, it so happens that a two-dimensional worm would be very alarmed if he suddenly found a third-dimensional pole in his environment. This analogy is used by mathematicians to cow people who dare question the existence of a fourth dimension. They say, well, trying to find a fourth dimension would be, to a person used to three dimensions, like a two-dimensional worm finding a third dimension. That confuses everybody, and so people let mathematicians then go around happily saying, well, A equals B and the square root of Boolean algebra as turned over to the Rudy rod makes and demonstrates equatively a fourth dimensional existence, and nobody dares say, if they know about the two-dimensional worm, hey, that's the lousiest mathematics I ever saw, which it is. But this analogy has a much higher level of workability in Dianetics. That the man was going along on a two-dimensional basis. He didn't think there was any third dimension. The third dimension might be considered to be life. He knew he was alive, but particularly in the last 100 years, he's been building things which were alive. He's built some very beautiful locomotives. They're alive, obviously. They die, don't they? You let the fires go out in them and so forth, and they're dead. So you can start and stop life, and life, after all, is just an engine. Man eats, and you stuff food into a locomotive, don't you? So naturally, all human beings are just machines. They're carbon-oxygen engines. And so he didn't find anything else sitting there, so he said, well, now we've got it all solved, and 19 million people in the insane asylums, steady parade of people with psychosomatic illnesses walking in and out of the doctor's office at vast expense, war, and the Democratic Party, all of these various things taking place in the society, and, quote, science, unquote, going along very happily saying, you see, we got the problem all solved. My man is just another engine. He's a heat engine, and that's all there is to it, and we don't have to worry about it any further, and you say, hey, what about the 19 million insane psychosomatic illnesses? they don't exist. If they do exist, it's just because the machine's parts are wrong. Now, therefore, the way you cure psychosomatic illnesses, sanity, so forth, you got an engine, so everybody knows the way you fix steam locomotives, take off the left drive wheel, put it on the right drive wheel side, and put it on a machine shop lathe, and cut it down a little bit and put it back on, or you put a little bit more bushing on a piston, or you put a little bit more stuffing, or you clean out the flues. That clean out the flues is very interesting. As a matter of fact, I think this clean out the flues theory kept radio solvent for about 20 years. The clean out the flues theory was a very interesting theory from another standpoint. You know, that walk down the street, you see these things turning red and white stripes, barber poles. Well, if you look carefully at one, you will see in its symbolized design a basin. And that barber pole spin, and there's a basin there. That is the symbol of medicine. That means here we let blood. And of course, you clean out the flues, then you're in fine shape. So the best way to clean out the flues, you can't do it any other way, is just to cut a guy's artery and bleed for a while, or his veins, or something of the sort. And you collect this, and he's obviously well. Of course, nobody ever got well from this process, but everybody knew that all you had to do was clean the flues out of a steam engine that ran better. I don't know that there may not be any validity of any character whatsoever to comparing your data with the real universe. I mean, this might not be a useful procedure. Certainly it comes into question because it's been neglected so often. Cleaning out the flues then, carving up the parts, too many gimme-gahoojits on this engine, we'll throw three away. Now, medicine has been unable to build back into the body any part. Plastic surgery, they occasionally replace skin. But here is a rebuilding the part idea. Medicine's not been able to do this. They've hopefully tried to. They've done transplantation of parts, but they have not created a part, you might say, to transplant into the human organism. So all we can do is take away parts. And even in medicine, there is a statement made concerning this process. They call it sacrificing. The way you get people well is by causing them to sacrifice. You got to give up cigarettes. You got to give up eating. You got to give up this. You mustn't work so hard. You must take it easy. You must take a rest. In other words, take away a guy's work. Take away a guy's interest. Take away a guy's... And then they got all this from the basis of... Taking away parts off the steam engine. Fellow had a wart, you burned it off. Now, that isn't so bad, but the fellow has skin, which might possibly be cancerous, cut it off. A fellow's hand is suffering from gangrene. Now, his arm isn't doing so well, or it gets in... The only limit on the sacrifice technique is, of course, the whole body. And then the undertakers can make money with it. But the point is here that they applied this to the mind. Now that's what's wonderful, is that they would take something they knew nothing about whatsoever and start to cut it up or shoot electricity into it. And then over here on this column, you start to add up all of the data and you find out nobody gets well with these techniques. But obviously you fix a steam engine by blowing the flues out or taking the piston, putting it in the old one, or you find out that the levers aren't working quite right, so you put a new connection on the levers and cut out the old complicated connections and so forth. Obviously, this is the way to fix steam engines. So they go ahead and they carve on the prefrontal lobes and they carve on this and they carve on that and they burn it up with electricity and they carve on something. And nobody's getting well. Everybody's getting sicker. People who formerly would get angry and scream, and so on, they fix them up so they don't get angry and scream. And then they write it down in their medical record and say, improvement was noticed in this symptom. And they don't add on the same column that this preclair was no longer able to control any bodily function. Preclair, I'm calling. That's because we've already taken over all the institutions, actually. So, Nobody got well over here with this technique. Nobody compared it to the real universe. But it kept on being done. All I'm trying to demonstrate to you is about 100 years ago, this whole field hit a dead end. And for 100 years, or something like that, the two-dimensional worm has been walking on a two-dimensional plane. And once in a while, somebody like Freud, somebody like that, would walk along this two-dimensional plane and all of a sudden run into something. Boom. There's not supposed to be anything there. There'd be a third dimension, and there is no third dimension, so therefore there's nothing there. And he got it happily and explained it all by Rudy Rods and Jimmy Gahugis, and the rabbits come out of the hat anyhow, and you've seen it on the stage, so it's just another sort of a situation. We just ban the whole thing. Obviously, nothing can happen. Well, another two-dimensional worm comes crawling along, and he hits this pole. No pole there, obviously. Next worm comes along, he hits the pole. Well, the first few worms will go off and they will say to all the other worms, hey, there's a pole back there, a third dimension. And the other worms all say, yeah, you've been to see your psychoanalyst lately? And the other worms go over there and they walk all across the area and they don't find this pole, so they say, why, isn't that? That's what we've done in Dianetics, essentially. We ran into this darn pole and started up it. The process of going up the pole. Now, any worm who gets up this pole any distance is liable to get rather dizzy. And he starts looking around and he tries to tell the other two-dimensional worms about it, and they say, nyah, you're not up any pole. It doesn't exist. So he begins to wonder about himself. Process of research in Dianetics has been a better and better identification of this pole. And this pole, the name of it, is life, quote, energy, unquote. It exists, but it doesn't exist, but it exists. Wonderful stuff. It is an energy that doesn't follow the rules of other energy. It's confusing. You see, it doesn't have wavelength, mass, or weight, which immediately strikes it out as existing in the material universe. Because if it existed in time and space and had no wavelength, mass, or weight, of course it wouldn't exist, which would immediately throw it out. But it does exist, because there's something there. Now, this is the level of the second echelon, is taking this position, this viewpoint on how life is operating in the material universe and looking at the material universe from this point of operation. Here you are with the pole. A little bit up the pole, all we're looking at this time is the two-dimensional plane. Here we are a little bit up the pole. We know this pole. We know as long as we consider there's a pole there, we get good results. But the second we say, nah, there's no pole here, we don't get any results. So by test alone, we know that there is a pole. What this life energy is, its identification, isolation, conduiting of it, whatever else can be done with it, is the second echelon of research. So we are taking the viewpoint of this borderline between echelon 1 and echelon 2 in research and looking back at the material universe and finding out what this energy is doing to the material universe. Taking that viewpoint and doing that permits us to accomplish a considerable advance in knowledge. It permits us even to examine knowledge itself. We have cracked something that they've been trying to crack for a long while. Epistemology, the study of knowledge. What is knowledge? We find out, first and foremost, that knowledge, life energy, identical. That thought, knowledge, and life energy are the same order of magnitude from the same source. They may be different facets of the same thing, but they are more or less the same thing. When you think of knowledge, you can think of it being life energy. When you think of thought, you can think of it being life energy. Because what you're studying is the effect of this Q factor, this theta, which is theta, after all, a mathematical symbol applied to something which is inexactly known. This theta viewpoint on the material universe. The second we get that viewpoint, we get some very interesting things. The whole physical universe starts to take on a different complexion to us, and we start to be able to handle it much better. I have written down here a few very basic axioms concerning this. Basically, all thought is concerned with motion. That's an axiom. All thought is concerned with motion. Now, that might seem very strange, but it's concerned with what motion? It's concerned with physical universe motion. That's the motion it's concerned with. It's concerned with vibration in space and time. And its concern with this motion is the calculation of effort. That's all anybody ever thinks about, the calculation of effort. Effort is motion and direction. That is to say, you channel motion into a certain direction. This is channeling effort. Now, I want to give you a very, very small example of what I mean when I say that thought is concerned with effort. A conclusion. One takes a lot of data and he makes a conclusion out of this data. Conclusions are directed toward the inhibition, maintenance, or acceleration of effort. In other words, the calculation of effort and the direction of effort. But effort has direction anyhow. Here's a man walks up to a table. He says, I'm going to pick up this table. He makes a calculation of how much physical effort he is going to put forward into picking up this table. And he picks it up. No difficulty. That's very easy. He's right. That's being right. He makes a calculation of how much effort it takes to pick up this table. Now, he calculates effort to pick up the table. What's that? Says, well, experience tells him the table weighs so much, tension has got to be so much, his hands have got to be in such and such place, so on. All that calculation is all done automatically. But if he leans over here and he says, I'll pick up the table. Wrong calculation of effort. That's being wrong. That's all there is to being right and wrong. Or he walks over here, makes a calculation of effort. He calculates that this table is terrifically heavy. It's very light. He picks it up, bomb. Did you ever feel particularly silly of having calculated that you are at the bottom of a step? All right, that is the physical representation of being right and wrong. Now, thought is a physical fact, I mean a thought facsimile of a physical action. A datum, in other words, is an observation of physical action. You get a lot of data together and you have a number of observations of physical action, and from this you can postulate a conclusion. And that conclusion has to do with nothing but effort, that's all. No matter how complex the problem, no matter how high the imagination flies, no matter what morals, ethics, or anything else are involved in this, it is nothing more nor less than a calculation of effort. There are many types of effort which can be calculated. They all stem from physical effort. Thought is estimate of effort. Words are descriptive of physical effort. And you get the interesting thing that on the basis of the amount of effort which has been expended in the past, one learns what effort can be expended in the future. One learns from what effort has been received in the past, or counter effort to his own effort, whatever counter the efforts have been received in the past, he can estimate future counter efforts. The whole test of whether or not his calculation is correct is solely workability. Does it forward his conquest of the physical universe? If it actually forwards his conquest of the physical universe along all his dynamics, that then is a good calculation. If his calculation does not forward, it is wrong wherever it fails to accomplish his conquest of the physical universe. A solution is as wrong as it fails to aid any of the dynamics. Now, the calculations are directed toward, one, the inhibition or destruction of hostile counter-efforts, efforts hostile to the survival along any of the dynamics, inhibition, decrease of those efforts, and the increase and promotion of assisting efforts, pro-survival efforts. The organism is trying to build up, multiply, enhance, maintain, increase all of those existing efforts in the physical universe which will assist it in its survival. And it is trying to destroy, knock out, remove, uninhibit, kill, dampen, put aside, vanquish, make vanish any effort hostile to its survival along any dynamic. Aberration is measurable by this factor alone, whether an individual accomplishes the destruction and inhibition of hostile things or doesn't. An individual who encourages or fosters hostile things along any of the dynamics is aberrated. An individual who kills, depresses, suppresses any of the dynamics, any action in the physical universe which is friendly to the dynamic, is aberrated. And he's aberrated to the degree that he reverses this optimum solution. An American suddenly harbors an enemy spy. That's aberrated. Obviously, because as an American, it is in his interest to favor his country. There he, supposedly, his best survival lies, and not only his own survival, but he has a dynamic answering this. And he's all of a sudden favoring and multiplying something which is hostile to his country. That's aberrated. Here is somebody who is favoring murder, killing, so forth. Now, he is favoring the murder or death of individuals who are needed by other individuals, so therefore this is aberrated. Now, you get the difference between aberration and sanity. Sanity is the measure of how ably an individual assists things which assist survival and inhibits things which inhibit survival. That's sanity. And insanity is an individual assisting things which inhibit survival and destroying things which assist survival. In other words, on the one hand, an individual assists what shouldn't be assisted and inhibits what shouldn't be inhibited. Now, this is calculation of effort. It all boils down to this, calculation of effort. You can see, then, that an individual who is ignorant can give a manifestation of insaneness, you see? An individual who doesn't have data can then go out and make the most fantastic blunders. Little Willie goes out and he gets in your car. And he turns on the car keys, and the car's in gear, and it's got the brake on, and he steps on the start. And the starter gears fly off like somebody's teeth in a dentist chair. And he doesn't give a darn. It's nothing to him, it's nothing to him, it's nothing to him. Only it sure is. That car is used to go to the grocery store to get groceries. And little Willie's fond of eating. That car is used to take Papa to work where he makes money, which buys groceries and pays the rent And little Willie's very, very fond of having a dry house to sleep in. So his data is all haywire. This is why kids look insane to so many people. They don't have data. So they'll do weird things. Except a lot of kids go out and do these things well knowing their result. There they have been turned around to a point where they're trying to destroy their own family. You say, well, it's quite accidental. It's just childlike for him to go outside the window every night when I come home and scream while I'm trying to read the newspaper. Well, it's just children. That's the way they are, you know. Walk in the front door, find roller skates on the front step, and so forth. Well, it's just children are careless. Oh, yeah. This kid has had it demonstrated to him that everything around him is so anti-child survival that this kid begins to strike back in the only way he knows, covert with roller skates and so forth. But from the viewpoint of the child, the adult who inhibits the survival of a child, the adult is crazy to do this. And from the standpoint of the adult, the child is crazy to do this. Works very aberrated both ways. But there's an existing data. For the lack of data, a person can be very aberrated. You take troops. Troops are usually very ignorant. They come into a city, and they blow up its libraries and draw mustaches on all of the master's paintings in the galleries and so forth. They do this just because they're stupid. They just know data. They don't see how art applies to a city or how art helps anybody's culture or helps any survival in any direction. Art's just sort of nonsense. Anybody that paints damn poor. They just never got the data. It may seem to you that saying that the mind is concerned wholly with the estimation of effort would be a rather extreme statement, but it's not. It's a very basic statement, terrifically basic. I'll tell you why this is. We have a universe of motion. Here we are standing from the point of view of theta without identifying theta too well, but from the viewpoint of theta, we have a universe of motion. The only way we can do anything with this universe of motion is by taking the inherent forces and natural laws of that universe and turning its forces against itself. Here's a few ergs of energy. They come in this way. Life is doing the same trick as the fellow who plays a very good game of tennis and who knows how to make a bucket out of his racket. His racket's up here. The ball comes over at the speed of light, and if he immediately faced that ball and hit it as hard as he could hit it, it'd probably go right on through the racket, unless he rolled the ball off the racket. In other words, he comes on this side, and as he hits the ball, all he's got to do is roll his racket that way a little bit, and the ball will come in and go right back on its own velocity. A reflection of direction. He changes the direction of the ball and uses some of the energy in the change. Now, that's what life's doing. Theta takes facsimiles of all of this force, all of this effort, direction, and so forth in the physical universe, takes facsimiles of it, and then fits these facsimiles together, and every time the physical universe fires another volley, fires it right back to the physical universe. And the first thing you know, Theta knows an awful lot about the laws of the physical universe. And an engineer goes out here and he sees a great big roaring river like the Columbia, and the Columbia is roaring along there, and he says, I think I'll put a dam across this thing, and I think I'll fix up this whole plain here and make a lot of new agricultural land and make a lot of electricity and new wealth. How does he do it? One of the first ways he does it is to dam up the river and use its force. He makes its force dam itself up in the coffer dam. He uses the force of the river to do many things. Now, some other river someplace has already been conquered. So it's furnishing force, and it's furnishing electricity, and it's making tools. And he takes these tools and conquers this new river. At no time does Theta apply any actual direct energy to the physical universe. But at all times, Theta takes physical universe motion and energy and applies it to the physical universe. And in order to do this, takes pictures, facsimiles of the stuff, and uses this to measure the incoming forces and throw them out again. The conquest of the physical universe is learning a little bit about the physical universe and turning it back on itself again. Then you know more, and you've got more weapons, so you do more about it. It's very hard for anybody to conceive what would happen, what happens in the manufacture of a culture. How does a culture come into being? How many factors are contained in that culture? How much knowledge is contained in it? And how much physical universe force is there, which has been thrown into that culture and is redirected back into the physical universe again? It is fantastic, the terrific quantity of it. If you suddenly drop some atom bombs on American cities, you'd knock out a carburation plant here, a plant that made the clamps that make it possible to manufacture copper wire there, a radio shop someplace else, which is the only radio shop that really knows how to solder, and you knock out a big steel corporation someplace else, and then you knock out the little guy who does all of the figuring on computers for the Burroughs Adding Machine Company. And all of a sudden, war, rolling destructively across any nation in the past, was destructive to that nation not by destroying men, but by destroying the techniques by which that nation caught the physical universe on the fly and threw it back to the physical universe. Here is this tremendous network of culture, and all of a sudden, war rolls across. There went the Greeks. There went Rome. If somehow or other you could preserve this culture, it'd be all right. How long does it take to educate one guy in college? This is beside the point of whether it's worthwhile or not. How long does it take to educate him? The Germans used to very practically use police dogs for scouting duty, and they said very practically it takes 2 years to build and train a dog. It takes 21 years to build and train a man. Therefore, it is more economical to use dogs. This is very unemotional computation of only Germans are capable of this sort of thing. But that's 280,000 this year before last, 2 years ago, 280,000 young men and women graduated in this country with the degree of Bachelor of Arts. Beside the point of whether or not they were artists, but the point is, here are people who have been given an enormous amount of technology and who can apply that technology in their average everyday living. Boy, it takes years and years and years, scores of years, and really hundreds and thousands of years for a culture to come up from scratch to a point where it learns just this one thing. How do you calculate the counter efforts of the physical universe and translate them and reconquer the physical universe with those counter efforts by putting out your own efforts? You see, in comes this counter effort, you turn it into an effort of your own, and it goes out again. How anybody could contemplate blowing up civilization, it makes one tired to think of trying to put together a civilization like that. It's a very exhausting thought. But here, one would think offhand that if all civilization were destroyed on the face of the earth, life would never rise again. If all life were destroyed on the face of the earth, it is not even true to say that life, organisms, and man would not come into existence again. But boy, it'd sure be a setback. The modus operandi of conquering the physical universe doesn't exist very much in the hands of earthworms. They do pretty well. They keep the soil churned up so the trees and grass can grow and a lot of other things. It isn't very solidly in the hands of tigers. It certainly isn't in the hands of donkeys. In spite of what Truman thinks. But it's not any one of these species is capable of gross conquest, big conquest. You take a mountain that sits here in the middle of a town, and then you go into it with hydraulic hoses and steam shovels and you move the mountain over someplace else. Boy, that's big stuff. Man is capable of that. Life can exist as a solid staff. Now first, the little unit which can live on sunlight and minerals. And that supports a unit which is a little less basic and a little more complex. And a little less basic, and a little more complex, and each time has a little bit greater mobility. until you finally work it up to a point where you've got a good, workable organism which can translate this effort analytically and handle it. In other words, gross conquest. You can look at this, and what is it all the way on up? It's a calculation of effort. Right down there in the most basic effort, you've got the effort of taking sunlight and minerals and making biochemical byproducts, which is a wonderful gimmick. I sometimes wonder if the algae and plankton might not know a lot more about life than man. But here's your basic on the thing. Now you work it on up into a staff of complexity that gets higher and higher and more complex. Each time it's a calculation of effort. More effort. So as you get what all these life forms are doing. Any life form then is supported down to this basic unit by other life forms. You get the importance of a life form to life. A life form to life is as important as it itself conquers the physical universe, or as it supports whatever is conquering the physical universe as a life form. It's either important for supporting or important for doing. We get a tremendous, complex, coordinated effort, which is not very random when we really think of it as to what is supporting man's conquest of the physical universe. Some fellow down here decides he wants brown bread. He's going to sell brown bread because people have heard that brown bread is healthier than white bread. Therefore, you just color white bread brown, and people will buy more of it. Whether or not this is desirable is beside the point. But the point is that a lot of little bacteria will really get in there and slug for him. And the next thing you know, he's got the finest brown dye in the world, and he can color that white bread. All around us, we see life forms which are using the forces of the physical universe. Each one of those life forms is in the same position of viewpoint. It is observing the motion of the physical universe and is coordinating that motion into effort and is utilizing it for further conquest of the physical universe. Each species, each entity, takes what is inhibitive to its own survival and seeks to destroy it, takes whatever assists its own survival and seeks to support it. A very, very beautiful, complex plant. Really makes sense when you look at it from this standpoint. But it makes sense, if only from this viewpoint, that by knowing these things, you can make a high, complex organism such as man much more effective in his operation against the physical universe by disinterbulating this individual from the effects of past upset when the counter efforts were too strong or too weak to support it. That's what we're doing. We're just fixing it up so that individuals can better assist those things which assist them and inhibit those things which inhibit them. And fix it up so that we as individuals aren't surrounded by a lot of life forms that have been hit by so much counter effort in all different directions that they begin to assist things which inhibit it to survival and which inhibit things which assist survival. Now, there's a very... that's insane, that's crazy, that's aberrated, that's a lot of other things. And that's all insanity, craziness, and being aberrated is. Calculation of effort. A man is as intelligent as he can calculate effort. Intelligence also consists in bringing alignment into randomity. But I'm not going to cover randomity as a definition and so forth and show you what learning is and tell you a little then about effort processing until the second part of this session. Let's take a break.